one who's prepared for the future, and one who deals cleverly with any situation that may arise, are both happy. But the fatalistic one, who wholly depends on luck, is ruined. A quote by Chanakya, also known as Kautilya or Vishnugupta, who lived around 300 BC in India. He was an Indian teacher, philosopher, and a royal advisor. He served as the chief advisor to both Chandragupta and his son Bindusara, whose son was Emperor Ashoka. Hello, my name is Malati, and I'm your host on the show titled The Impressive Empress, where we celebrate and amplify the voices of women, providing insightful conversations, stories, and inspiration to help more girls and women embrace their power, purpose, and potential in all aspects of life. The idea behind this show is to understand what it takes for a woman to become a leader, to understand the journey from within, the journey to becoming a female leader with a higher purpose. Today, I'm with yet another lady who's creating a huge impact in this world through her amazing work. It gives me immense pleasure to talk to these women leaders, discussing their struggles, challenges, leadership, and celebrations. Meet Deepa, a trailblazer in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion, known for her strategic vision, impactful initiatives, and commitment to fostering inclusive workspaces. With over 13 years of experience, Deepa's journey is not just about climbing the corporate ladder, but about dismantling barriers, making real changes, and paving pathways for others. Starting off in marketing and internal communications, Deepa made a bold move into diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, she's not just any strategist. She's the one who sits down with top leaders working to make sure everyone feels valued and included in the workspace. But here's what sets Deepa apart. She's not just focused on big corporate goals. She's out there pushing for better opportunities for people with disabilities and the LGBTQ plus community. She's launched cool projects like the Redefine Abilities and Diversity Recruitment that aim to shake things up in a good way. And she's not stopping there. Speaking at places like TEDx and other international forums, Deepa's voice echoes as an accessibility evangelist, championing a world where inclusion isn't just a buzzword, but a lived reality. Honored with accolades like this Karnataka State Award and the Helen Keller National Award, she's more than just a leader. She's an inspiration. So, let's celebrate Deepa, a visionary, a change maker, and a living testament to the transformative power of inclusion as we embark on this journey today, where she'll be talking to me about being authentic, daring, and vulnerable, amongst many other things. Very good afternoon, Deepa. I'm so happy to have you as one of the speakers today for our podcast, The Impressive Empress. Very happy that you could take this time out and join us and try to inspire more women in our
Thank
life.
Thank you so much, Malati. It's a pleasure to be here. I've heard a couple of podcasts in your website. Really, I think the word inspire sometimes is more than that, right? It kind of gives you that energy when you really look into stories. And I'm glad I could be here to share my journey.
Thanks, Deepa. Could you share a couple of stories from your growing up years that helped you? I know you're a change agent in the D&I space. A couple of stories and something about yourself that we could share with the audience.
Absolutely. I think I've come a long way, Malati. And, you know, sometimes I put all of these into capsules when I have to really talk about my journey. But it's not been easy to put into capsules sometimes, right? And I'm still experiencing certain things that has kept evolving over a period of time. So just looking back at my childhood, I'm from a Tambaram family. So when you know, and everyone knows Tambram is, you know, living in a joint family. So I lived in a very big family. So we were around 18 people at home. So my grandpa and grandmom and my uncles, aunts, and everyone was there with us. So it was a big family. So every day we used to cook for 20 plus people. I've seen my granny do that very effortlessly. And my mom was working. She was a working mother. My mom worked for 40 years. Again, another big inspiration for me, both of them, my granny and my mom, because the time when they were working and they were doing stuff, it was, I would say, women were not even seen anywhere, but they have challenged every status quo. Right. So both of them have been like extremely inspirational for me and my role models, of course. So while I've seen Granny do all of this very effortlessly, taking care of the household chores to cooking, and, you know, it was like celebration every day for 20 people. Right. And she used to not make one dish. She used to make a full fledged meal. And today, when someone says eating a full-fledged meal is a privilege, but she used to do every single day. And there used to be the fresh grated coconut chutney, for example, that she used to put on the curries and stuff. And today we talk about diet, right, where we are saying coconut is so good, fibrous, healthiest. And she used to do that every day. So for me, looking back at my younger journey, I was born with a disability. I had a neuromuscular condition. And that itself was a, I would say, a finding for my parents, because they didn't know anything about my disability or my condition, right? Forget about disability. Disability is coined later part of my year. But when I was born, it was, as a normal child, I was the second one. I have two siblings. I have an older brother and a younger sister. So when I was born normal. My mom felt everything was as normal as what my brother was. But within the month of six or something, she just felt I'm not doing the earlier milestone, like turning around or holding on to things. But I was a very happy child even then. So she was like, okay, she's smiling. She's grabbing all our attention, but she's not doing much. So she took me to the doctor and she took me to a neurologist, and they figured out saying maybe it could be some sort of a delay progress, and they sent me back. There was no diagnosis, anything. They said, she's a chubby child, maybe give us a few more months and she should be okay. So my parents said, okay, and they came back and they didn't see anything till 1 year. So that's when they really got worried and they took me to the doctor, and the complete diagnosis was done. And, you know, they said it's a neurological condition and she might need help throughout her lifetime, right? The thing that doesn't affect her is her intellectualness, because my IQ was really good because they did certain tests which kind of took care of all the parameters. But my physical muscular power was very bad, and it was a deteriorating condition. It's called a spinal muscular atrophy, and it is a rare condition. You know, one in, I think, a million gets this, right? And it's rare, and my parents didn't know. So the only thing that they really heard was she needs help. And the doctor just left them blank with the help part of it. So they came home and they saw me. And I mean, since we lived in a joint family, they kind of shared this to my grandparents. And my grandparents said, don't worry, we are there to take care of her, right? And we'll do whatever best for her and you don't have to worry. And things just went so beautifully after that. I think it was the positivity and someone reassuring, saying, don't worry, we'll figure it out as and when it comes. So my earlier childhood, I had very good schooling. I went to school, my schooling was done in a very beautiful way, because we had a school right next to my house, and everyone, my parents, that is my dad, my uncles, my cousin uncles, everyone studied in that school. It was a convent school. and it was very well known, and it was right next to my house. So I studied in that school till the class 7th. So there used to be my uncle who used to lift me, put me into the class, and then someone used to come and pick me. It could be my granny or my or my mom coming and picking me from the class. So I did my schooling till class 7th. And I dropped out. That's because after that, it was a high school. High school was far away from home. High school was a girls' high school. And I had to put a pause on my studies then. That's when the challenge really started, to be honest. Right. And if I look back, the challenge was, again, you know, more societal than what was within our purview, because my parents really wanted me to study further. But they went to the high school. They said, we want to enroll her into the class 8. But they refused, saying, you know, the classes, the students have to keep moving to different classes based on the subjects. The teacher wouldn't come to the class. So you got to take your books and keep running. I don't know, Malti, if you have gone through something like that in your earlier school, but that's how it was designed in ours.
Yeah. I've heard of such schools also. I mean, luckily, in the school I went to, we didn't have to move around.
Okay.
But just to let others know, to the listeners know what spinal muscular atrophy means. It's a kind of a genetic condition that makes the muscles weaker and causes problems with movement. Apparently, there's no cure, but I think you can get some kind of a help. Like you mentioned, you need lifelong help. I also read somewhere that you can't move any muscle other than your hand. Am I right in that? Am I understanding?
Other than my fingers.
Fingers. Oh.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Currently, I'm in a stage where I can just move my index finger. Since it's a deteriorating condition, it's not like I've never moved my hands. At one point, I was able to wear my own lipstick, do my own hair. But then, for the last 10, 12 years, you know, it's been deteriorated to a point where I'm not able to move much of my hands. I can't lift my hands. I can't hold my cup of coffee. I can't brush my teeth. So I need help for all of these. And walking or standing just passed away even before my teenage. I think I could stand until I was 12. And after that, I couldn't stand as well. Even standing was more from a support. Like if someone just makes me stand, I used to just hold a wall and stand. And then I lost that. So it's been too much of deterioration over a period of time. And I'm seeing that this is not going to stop, because muscles are across our body, right? And we're made out of muscles. So this condition is a little fatal, to be honest, but it's not that fatal. It's very slow. I wouldn't know what I'm losing today, to be honest. And, you know, it takes months or years together, especially the pandemic, right, has affected a lot. I think the medicine also has affected my body a bit more. And this is across the community. I've spoken to a few others as well, and they also feel the same. And the pandemic also didn't allow many of us to move around much. We were just inside homes. That was another barrier for me to lose a lot of strength, because I was very active. I kept going to work, and I used to work for 14 hours, and suddenly I was at home. Though I was working from home, it was very sedentary being in a room and, you know, connecting to your laptop. So that's affected me a lot as well.
Yeah. I mean, just to listen to you in a few sentences about what all you cannot do. From there, you've moved to a stage where you are a change maker, kind of making things possible for many, many, many more people in the societies and in the corporates. It's a very, very inspiring and impactful journey, Deepa. I mean, I really admire the courage and the resilience with which you've worked. Could you please share your journey where you moved from this feeling of helplessness to the stage where you said, okay, I have to do, I can do, you know, and I will do?
Yeah, so I would say I've never felt that, Malati. There was no two different state of mind at all. Like I said, you know, my parents or my extended family, my uncles, my aunts, and everyone, not even one person told that you may not be able to do something, or they've never given me that feeling. It's always like, okay, she needs this and, you know, we're there to help her, or she needs this, we'll buy her, you know, something. Like, if I have to give you an example, when the whole computer PC system came to India, it was in 99, 98. It was booming. Everyone had a PC at home. And I wouldn't say everyone, even then, right? People rarely had one PC in 99. I had one at home. Right. And that was just for me. My parents put a big, huge loan just to buy me a PC. And no one knows what is PC. No one knows what's technology. And that's because we had certain cyber cafes. We went there. I went there especially. I loved it. And I said, I want one. And I said, let me go back to that cyber cafe and enjoy 1 hour of internet. And they said, taking you there is going to be a challenge, but we will buy one for you. So, you know, like that, anything and everything that I needed was given to me. So I've never felt, oh my God, I'm helpless or I'm not able to do something. They empowered me throughout. And again, these words like empower is something that I've really understood now. But when I look back, it was, I got it. And they saw me in a space of inclusive kid. They didn't do anything different for my brother or myself or my sister, right? They did equally and sometimes even more for me because I might need something more, and they were ready to do that for me. So there was never at all a transition saying, oh my God, I felt this and I felt that. But yes, there was certain acceptance within myself because my siblings were going to the school. I was at home. So for 15 years, I was at home. So my high school, my degree, and then until I found a job. So it took me 15 years. I was pretty much at home, right? And of course, I enjoyed going out here sometimes for a family function or going out for a vacation, but more or less being at home. I studied myself. I didn't have a Vedantu kind of a platform, right? Means nowadays you have so many platforms to study. I didn't have any of those, but then I had to do it all by myself. I had a cousin who was studying. She was my age, so I used to take notes from her and study. I wrote my exams through correspondence. I did my bachelor's in computer applications. So did all of that all on my own, without no self-help. But self-help means, of course, I had my cousins who could just come and help me. My brother helped me with certain subjects, but then more or less studying on my own. But I was very disciplined, you know. And thanks that, you know, we were not spoiled with so much choices of technology there, like no YouTubes, no cell phones. So I kept myself very disciplined. I used to tell my granny, I'm going to study from like 9 to 2 until my brother comes. I'm going to also be in the room and study. So very disciplined. So I did that. So nothing, you know, stopped me, and no one stopped me. No one said, oh my God, why are you doing this? Nothing at all. They gave me in a platter. And I was very demanding as well, to be honest. So the self-acceptance part a bit was, why am I different? Why am I going through these challenges? Why me? So I had to face that a lot, especially when I was in the teenage times. I also want to experience like what my brother is experiencing in a college, and I couldn't do that. So I had that regret. I had the sadness. So I did go through a phase where I was very upset. I used to tell my granny, Patti, I used to tell her, like, why me? You know, why me? Why should I, you know, be like this? And, you know, she's always given her own examples of why us, why one person, right? And she's always, you know, empowered me, saying, you know, you should be aware of your own self-worth. Then you know, people are looking up to you. I think you should always put yourself first. Right. And those are things that really helped me. And I also took time to understand what my condition was. Until then, I didn't even know what my condition was. Sometimes my mom or my family has called me, I'm lazy to do things. Right. But it's not lazy. It was my muscle power that was deteriorating. So, it felt like I'm not doing things because I'm just lazing out. And then slowly I really, that's when the whole internet happened. I understood about this SMA. Then I got to know, it's not me who's not pushing myself to do more, but it's the condition. Right. So once I accepted that, I was like, okay, bang on. Like, I know I'm not setting myself back now. I'll do things that I am empowered to do, or I'm going to be doing. That started with blogging. That started with sketching. I used to do a lot of pencil sketches. That started with writing my own journey in my blog back then. Like, I'm talking about, again, 2000s, right? The whole IT thing happened, right? Those point in time. And there were a lot of people who read my blog saying, the blog was very depressing, very sad, saying, I just saw the sunrise through my window, kind of a thing. But I also did my artistic work and I uploaded them, saying, today I was able to sketch and upload that. So they said, you're very creative. You're, very, very dynamic in your learning, your capabilities, how you write about yourself. Why don't you, do a career in graphic design? So these were words that I just got through these blogs, words that I could just capture. And that's when I also got introduced to disability as a word, saying, okay, I'm a disabled woman or I have a disability. Until then, I really don't know that word.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. I mean, in today's world, when kids complain for not having this or that, I mean, you are really an inspiration and a role model. You've pushed yourself beyond so many challenges. And like you mentioned, I looked at the sun today. It's a kind of a ray of hope, I should say. Listening to you is like, very, very motivating. I think your family has been and is continuing to be your backbone, providing you the kind of strength, both emotionally and physically. I think listening to you, your family as such, your mom working throughout and your grandma always being there for you, must have been a challenge for them also. How did your mom manage this, if I may ask?
Yeah, I've asked her this question in very recent years, right? And there were two different things I've asked my mom. I've questioned my mom after all of this. Today, I myself have a 15 years of experience in career. So my mom did 40 years, in her job. And she stuck to one big company. It's a private sector and she stuck all the 40 years with one company. So I used to ask her how did you were able to stick through one, company for so long? And I've also asked her how did you manage? Because we talk about work-life balance and how are you managing three kids, one special kid, right? And so one thing my mom said was of course, when she started her career path, it was, there used to be ads saying women don't apply. Right. So she's seen ads where, it used to be very, sales executive or an executive job, very clearly calling out saying women don't apply. She's been from that era. Yeah. Right. So she's been an executive herself. So she said, I found ways to apply for this private public sector. I applied and, I went through and she's done very tough job, which very equivalent to a man. Right. Those kind of very tough physically also sometimes, when they have to do certain tasks. So she's done that. And then she said, when you were born, of course, the family was the biggest strength for her. She said, your granny said, I'm there for Deepa. I will take care of her. Like, not only Deepa, means all the three kids my granny took care of. So she said, I relied on the family. right, to take care of all of you. So that was another big support system for her. And later part, when we had to move to our own home and she was still working, I supported her. I said, Ma, I think you should continue. You love working. You shouldn't take a VRS, for example. VRS is a volunteering retirement. I said, you should continue and don't worry. I think I will be able to manage myself. And even then, with the kind of lack of physical movement that I had, I still managed to manage the home, manage myself, and study on my own, while everyone just left doing their own tasks. My brother was studying college, so he went to college. My sister was going to school. My dad was working. They used to just lock the house, give the key to me happily, and they used to leave. And I used to be at home taking care of my home and et cetera, et cetera. So I think I've supported my mom as well. So for my mom, she always says, it's not just me. It's all of you. Right, who has given that support and who's given that hand, you know, for me to work for 40 years, even without looking back. And she used to do even overtime. It's called OT. And she used to do OT also. I'm like today, you know, when, you know, we talk about like 40 hours of work or 70 hours of work, people, youngsters really complain saying, okay, I don't have my own personal time and stuff. But my mom, she really worked hard for all of this. And it's an ecosystem. I think the family needs to come together for supporting. And that's where the role of the husband or the role of the mother-in-law, the children also come in place. And we were all brought up in very, I would say, self manner, where we were able to do tasks on our own, like, you know, wash our clothes or, you know, vessels. My brother used to help, you know, doing vessels sometimes. We used to not have maid coming and supporting us. So we kind of took certain tasks that enabled us. So I would say this journey and the challenge was more to do with how we supported her. But if it comes to me in particular, I think I took on the baton on my own. I am what my disability is when I learned about it my own. Because my parents really didn't know. The doctor just gave them a hint saying she might need help. They didn't tell them anything more than that. So I, you know, told my parents, like, and that too after I was teen and I was able to understand many things. I said, I'm going to be doing certain things that I love and, you know, be there to support. So I went to a lot of interviews, you know, before I cracked the first job. Because we had a lot of bias in the system and we back then didn't have something called the diversity and inclusion as well in many organizations. So I was someone who was standing very differently in the crowd of, you know, joining. And yeah, so they supported me throughout. They saw my challenges, but they also know that I'm not someone who will break down for a challenge. I was always very solution-oriented. So I used to be like, Ma, why can't we do this? Or can we try this one? I may want to do this. So I'm very experimental as well. And I've tried out things. So I think that's been, I think, very helpful for them to see my growth. You know, initial years, of course, my parents have heard saying, like, Deepa's at home. Like, who's going to take care of her? But today they very proudly say Deepa takes care of 10 other people. So yeah, it's been a transformation. But again, it's been slow. It's been how we support each other and been through a lot of challenges. But still, those challenges were stepping stones for us.
I mean, what are some of the adjectives or some of the skills that you think has helped you reach where you are today, where like your parents proudly say, from who's going to take care of Deepa to Deepa takes care of so many more. What are some of the adjectives that you can associate yourself with?
Yeah, so I would say a couple of ones, right? So I'm, you know, currently in a position where I lead an organization. I lead a particular department, like the diversity, equity, and inclusion. So for me, being at a leadership position it brings a lot of, I would say, authenticity, you know, to the board. So today, when I'm very authentic about my life journey, right, when I say how I've come to this space, how I was able to lead, you know, and how I was able to transition being like someone who found a job to, you know, being home for 15 years and then found a job, found, you know, within the job, within a year, I was able to, you know, get a lot of people really seeing my work and appreciating my work to, you know, leading a department. So earlier I was with marketing and communication. I learned the skill, you know, and certain things to do on my own, on the job, trained on the job. I never went to a BB school, to be honest. Today, when I work on, say, strategy and execution, these are things nobody taught me in a very logical step. But these are things that I've seen other leaders. I've seen my mentors do it. I've seen my bosses do it. I've learned from them. It has been very learning through, you know, experiences, learning through being there, putting your foot into it. And I've taken challenges even at work. I've never been someone who said, maybe I don't want to. I've always been the one who's raised my hand saying, okay, let me volunteer for this. Let me do that extra bit. I was very involved at work. And today, a lot of the work that I do is to bring the whole marginalized communities, you know, into workforce. It's been a big challenge for many corporates to look into the diversity pool of, you know, recruitment, or how do we include them? How do we create a welcoming space for them? So the work that I do is very much evolving every day. The work that I do is how do we create a space for everyone to be able to thrive? And so for all of these, I bring my own lenses. I bring my own authentic leadership there. I also, you know, enable through, you know, mentoring others as well, because it's been a lot of people really don't get the kind of exposure suddenly I got, you know. So how do we get more people, you know, into this space? So mentoring, you know, others who are probably even, you know, finding it difficult to get entry into the, like, say, a workforce, for example. So these are the kind of things I'm able to do. And creating that change agent, you know, it was in ripple effect for me. Like, it started from me, but somewhere Deepa just got faded off, and it was more beyond than Deepa that I started doing. So being that change agent, being an authentic leadership, being vulnerable. You know, sometimes you have to bring your vulnerability to really make that change happen in the system, right, for us. Yeah. So that's another thing that I've put in place.
You mentioned authentic leadership. Maybe can you tell me what are the ways you stay true to yourself and your values as a leader, considering your unique experiences?
Yeah, so, you know, if your voice needs to be heard on the table, right, you need to bring your authentic self. And sometimes for a woman, and especially a woman with disability, you're going to be very much a single person in a boardroom or in a big decision-making space. But still, when you have that little space, I think you take ownership of it, right? And you take the credibility to bring the right voices, the right framework, the right value system. Right. So I wouldn't be like in a boardroom. And if I hear something that, you know, doesn't align with the overall organization, or it doesn't align with something that we're doing, I'll really, you know, pick up my voice. I'll always ensure that the voice is heard. Right. So being heard is very important. You know, sometimes you may make mistakes. I'm saying not everything can be perfect. Right, but making mistakes is also a way to learn. So putting yourself out there, I think, is extremely important. And I've done that. I've been in certain spaces where I'm the single woman on a wheelchair again. But I've been able to put my voice out there. And I've always ensure that, you know, I represent the community as well. I don't look only from my voice perspective. I look from how do we bring that inclusivity. It could be a training program. It could be we are building a process, for example. How do we bring that inclusive lens? And I constantly keep doing that. And it's something that, you know, everyone should do, because it's not just only for one community, but it's for the future. And the future with the technology is definitely disruptive. But how do we ensure that we take everyone along with us in this journey is important.
To work in the space where you have to meet people from diverse cultures and diverse abilities, I think it's your compassion that comes out, ensuring that the dignity, to borrow your own words, ensuring that the dignity of everyone is maintained. That's one great work that you're doing, Deepa. Now, to just conclude, I would like to ask you some rapid-fire questions. Are you game?
Yeah, of course. I love that.
Great. What is the one characteristic that you think every woman leader should possess?
Bringing herself up, always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are the three things that you are grateful for in life?
My family.
Mm-hmm.
My people that I was able to meet throughout my, you know, journey. It could be my bosses, it could be my mentors. I'm very fortunate to have some lovely people I get associated. I'm very, very grateful for that. And the last one definitely is the technology. Without technology, many of us would have been literally not doing many things. Today, technology is the big enabler. And especially for someone with a disability, I think technology is a biggest transforming space. It's biggest boom. So very happy in all of these three things.
Mm-hmm. For a total outsider, someone would consider you to be very successful doing the things that you are, given the opportunities that you have. But how would Deepa define success for herself?
That's a very good question. I've never put success into a very prospective way, to be honest. I've been putting success as how happy I can be, right? How I can impact someone, to be honest. Like, even if I can change one person's ability to make them smile or, you know, make them feel happier, I think that itself for me is a big success. So I've never defined success at all. And maybe it's also the role that I do, you know, puts me into a place where I've seen so many diverse people. So for me, success is just a perspective. It's just something that, you know, one says success in finance is too much, like having and owning certain, you know, things is successful, or having a grade, or, you know, in a corporate, or yeah, I mean, for me, success is never defined. Success for me is being happy and content to yourself. So that's for me success. And I see it in a very humble, I would say more humble way, I guess. So, yeah.
That's a very honest and authentic answer, if I may say so. I would like to wrap up here thanking you so much for the time that you have taken, and for sharing your experiences in the most, beautiful way. I'm just very emotional right now, but it's been amazing talking to you, Deepa, and we'll stay in touch. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Malati. Thank you so much. It was wonderful connecting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening in. I hope you liked this conversation and found it inspiring. If you think this could help transform minds, please feel free to share this podcast widely in your networks. You can listen to the Impressive Empress podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Stitcher, TuneIn, JioSaavn, at Player FM. Got a question that you want me to ask our next guest? Do write to me at empress@bogya.online, EMPRESS@ bhogya.online. That's it for now. Bye until the next time and take care.